What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the events of June 7th, 2016, Donald Trump Jr. sends an email, and Donald Trump gives a speech. And a group of international scientists are devising a plan to send messages into space to see if we're alone. But what if we're not? It's Friday, July 14th. Peter Baker, what did Donald Trump Jr. do in the late afternoon of June 7th, 2016?
Well, just after 6 o'clock in the evening, in fact, he hit the send button on an email confirming what we now, of course, consider a pretty famous meeting with a Russian lawyer who was supposed to be bringing him incriminating information about Hillary Clinton.
And Peter, can you read us the relevant line from Don Jr.'s email exchange?
Right. Well, Ron Goldstone, the intermediary setting up this meeting, told Don Jr. that this Russian government lawyer would provide, quote, some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. He goes on to say, this is, quote, obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but as part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump.
And several hours later, same day, the evening of June 7th, what happened with Don Jr.'s father, Donald Trump?
Wow. Thank you very much.
Well, just 3 hours later, Hello. He takes the stage at his Westminster Club in New York to claim victory in the final Republican presidential primaries mm-hmm. that are going to give him the nomination. But he's already thinking ahead to the general election. Mm-hmm. And in his speech, Donald Trump Sr. says,
I am going to give a major speech on probably Monday of next week. And we're going to be discussing all of the things that have taken place with the Clintons. I think you're going to find it very informative and very, very interesting.
Hillary Clinton, he said, turned the State Department into her private hedge fund.
The Russians, the Saudis, the Chinese all gave money to Bill and Hillary and got favorable treatment in return.
So, Peter, Donald Trump Jr. is on this day confirming a meeting in which he's been promised official documents that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and, quote, be very useful to your father. And just hours later, his father, Donald Trump, promises supporters that he will soon reveal Hillary Clinton's corrupt dealings with foreign governments, including, quote, the Russians. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. And obviously, this is an extraordinary coincidence if it's that. Donald Trump Jr. said he never told his father about this meeting, and the president said this week that he didn't know about it until a few days ago. But the timing obviously does lend itself to a lot of questions. It seems very extraordinary to happen that quickly. Now, look, politics is full of coincidences that look like conspiracy, and we shouldn't make any assumptions. But clearly, this will be a day that investigators will look at a little bit more closely in the future.
Right. With the idea in mind that potentially Donald Trump Jr., this son who works in the same building as his father and is an informal advisor on the campaign, potentially could have informed his father of this upcoming meeting and its promise of information about Russia and Hillary Clinton.
Well, that's what people would suspect, actually, right?
Right?
The sequence of events certainly lends itself to that interpretation. Of course, the two people involved both say, no, that's not true. That didn't happen. And what the president's aides say is, look, what he was talking about that night was something we had planned for quite a while. We always knew we were going to pivot to the general election that night. That's the last night of the Republican primaries. And we had this information from this book that had come out a year earlier called Clinton Cash by a conservative author who had talked about various things she had done as Secretary of State that seemed to to raise questions about propriety, including actions with Russia, particularly the approval by the State Department of a deal that permitted a Canadian company to secure uranium in the former Soviet regions. So there is another explanation there. But again, you know, the timing does lend itself to questions.
So to that point, to your knowledge, Peter, had President Trump said anything like that before, that he said the night of June 7th in New York to these supporters, suggesting that Hillary Clinton had corrupt dealings with Russia, or was this brand new?
Whether he's mentioned it in the past, this is the beginning of a new stage in his campaign where he's really focusing his fire on Hillary Clinton. And this is a theme he's going to return to again and again in the weeks and months to come. He ultimately doesn't even deliver the speech on the following Monday as he promised, they say, because it ended up coming a day after that terrible shooting in Orlando that killed so many people and it felt inappropriate. He did come back to it, though, a week or so later.
Hillary Clinton's State Department approved the transfer of 20% of America's uranium holdings to Russia.
So we have this third key figure here. What is Hillary Clinton doing around this time?
Right. That's the interesting thing, too, right? She had also begun attacking Donald Trump for being too close with Vladimir Putin.
And he said if he were grading Vladimir Putin as a leader, he'd give him an A. Now, I will leave it to the psychiatrist to explain his affection for tyrants.
Just a few days before all this, in fact, the day before Goldstone sent his very first email, she gives a speech in which she says that
if you don't know exactly who you're dealing with, men like Putin will eat your lunch.
So you can see the continuation of all of these events in the same time period really looks a little different today now that we've seen these emails.
Peter, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks. Good talking to you as always.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray, and that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to The New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
For decades, scientists have been scanning the skies for any evidence of intelligent life beyond Earth.
There's been this long tradition of listening to the cosmos, effectively, for signs of intelligent life, structured radio waves. It might be some kind of signal that we could pick up. But this is what they call sometimes passive, in the sense that all you're doing is listening to signals that are out there. You're not sending anything.
Stephen Johnson is reporting on a new group of scientists who call themselves METI.
Messaging extraterrestrial intelligence.
They want to take a more active role and actually initiate conversation. So, Stephen, tell me about the scientists at this organization, METI.
So I'm in the middle of writing a book about long-term decision making. And I gave a talk in San Francisco in January, the Long Now Foundation. And afterwards, Alexander Rose, who runs Long Now, came up and said, listen, you're interested in long-term decisions. I'm helping to advise this organization called METI that is working on this plan to send active messages targeted at planets that might support life. And if you think about it, given the timescales involved in the kind of transmission time, targeting a planet that might be 1,000 light years away or 25,000 light years away, you could decide to send a message and not get a reply for 50,000 years, potentially. And he was like, that is about as long-term a decision as you could possibly imagine. I mean, you know, it's hard to think up another choice that you could make, you know, in 2017, where the results of that choice wouldn't come back to you for 50,000 years. It's just hard to do that. And so he introduced me to this guy, Doug Vakush, who started this organization, Meti. And the more I dug into it, the more fascinated I got.
Hey, is this Doug?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Doug, it's Michael Barbaro from The Times. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. And your name is pronounced Vakush?
Vakush.
Vakush.
Perfect.
So, Doug, Meti has a plan here. What is that plan?
Well, our plan is by the end of 2018 to begin transmitting powerful, intentional signals to nearby stars in the hope of getting a response. And so this is an outgrowth of a search that has been going on for over half a century, a search to make contact with intelligence on other worlds. But until now, the focus has been almost exclusively on listening for signals.
In 1961, Frank Drake and a group of astronomers, physicists, and biologists formed a privately funded organization called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Their goal was to focus massive radio telescopes towards space and listen.
But what happens if other civilizations are doing exactly what we're doing, which is simply listening and not transmitting? And so this is a reflection of the maturation of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence by adding a new component which reverses the direction and has humankind taking the initiative.
Basically a greetings, say, hey, we're here. Would you like to engage in some intergalactic conversation?
Doug Vakush, we've been able to do this very thing you're describing, which is send a message into space for decades. So why now?
Well, because we have a knowledge that we didn't have when the search began, which is that there are planets everywhere.
And the discovery of another possible Earth-like planet.
There are actually seven Earth-sized planets orbiting
500
the nearby
new planets. They're all orbiting.
1,030 are confirmed planets. They're called candidates. If they
when the first SETI search happened in 1960, we knew of no stars that have planets around them. Now we look up the night sky and all of those stars, virtually every star has planets around it. And maybe one in five of those planetary systems has a planet at just the right distance from its star that it could support liquid water. So it's the Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold, just right. And so we now know of particular stars that we could target that we know to have planets, and they are in our own galactic backyard.
The challenge, of course, is that you're trying to figure out a way to communicate with another form of intelligence that has evolved in a completely different solar system. How do you communicate with a radically different form of intelligence? And what are kind of the base level things you can assume that they will have in common with us that you could use to kind of create some common referent?
So what message is Meti looking to send? What are we trying to say beyond, you know, what I imagine my first draft of it would be, which is, hello, I come in peace.
We're trying to think of the smallest possible message that we could send that would suggest that we're interesting and that we're worth kind of listening to.
There have been two broad approaches to creating a message. And one is exemplified by that
Arecibo message that was sent by the astronomer Frank Drake, sent in 1974 from the Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico, which is at the time the largest telescope in the world. And Drake had this idea of sending just a series of pulses, basically two tones when you translated them into audio,
which attempted to be encyclopedic. Even though it was a brief message, it tried to sample everything. So talk a little bit about our numbering system, about chemistry, what our DNA is like, what we look like,
our solar system,
the technology we use. And the problem of trying to send a message that covers everything is that it may just be a jumble and it's hard to understand anything. our strategy is just the opposite. Instead of this fixation on dumping a lot of data and trying to cover everything, cover just a few things very well. And so we are starting with the most basic principles of arithmetic and then using those to point to the signal itself. So, you know, that's how we learn language here on Earth. We point to things. But when we're sending radio waves, we're really limited to what we can point to. So we're pointing at the nature of the radio wave itself, that it has a certain frequency, that pulses have a certain duration. We introduce the concept of time. And then once we can do that, we can talk about how we use radio signals to communicate at great distances and how we use other sorts of waves to communicate with one another, say, through voice.
So rather than communicating something essential about human beings, you're communicating something about the very technology we're using to communicate.
That's right, because, you know, I wish we could just send them something in English or French or Swahili, but they're not going to understand that. So the question is, what do we and they have in common? And we have in common the technology to communicate.
Potentially.
If they get our signal, we know they can create a radio receiver. So what do you need to know to build a radio receiver? It seems like no matter where you are, you've got to be a good engineer. And if you don't know 2 + 2 = 4, you're not going to be in a very good position to create something as advanced as a radio receiver.
Now, Stephen, there is a very real fear here expressed by prominent engineers and prominent scientists like Elon Musk, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking says, if aliens visit us here on Earth, quote, the outcome would be much as when Columbus landed in America, which didn't turn out well for the Native Americans, end of quote. Make a note, he indicates we should stay away from them at all costs.
Yes, there is a very active and quite heated debate about this. So the argument is we are very young in terms of our mastery of radio technology, right? We've been tinkering with radio technology for about 100 years as a species. And if we do make contact with another species, they will be significantly more advanced than we will have been. And they potentially might have been tinkering with these kinds of technologies for millions of years. That means that you're talking about initiating contact with a much more advanced civilization. And the concern that many people have is that every time in the history of Earth that one advanced civilization has made contact with a less advanced civilization in terms of the technology, it has been very bad news for the less advanced civilization.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars.
That is an incredibly impactful vision, because cognitive psychologists tell us that when we are trying to interpret the risks of an unknown situation, we rely heavily on the vivid images that come to the fore. And what could be more vivid than that? But what you need to do is look at whether that is a reasonable assumption. And the key issue that Hawking ignores is that the civilizations he's worried about, the ones that can travel between the stars, they could already know that we're here. So any civilization with the ability to traverse the distances between the stars can already pick up I Love Lucy.
But this could be a risk. It sounds like you're acknowledging that it might not be, but that it could be, that the community that receives this message might, a la Stephen Hawking, respond aggressively in a way that could affect all of humanity. And yet, you all at METI are making a choice to take on that risk. So how do you grapple with that? And how do you grapple with the fact that you're making that decision in some ways on behalf of all of the rest of us?
I think it is easy for us to believe that an action has a greater risk than not taking an action. But we know that's not always the case. For example, there are people who will decide not to take the action of having a vaccine, and yet that exposes themselves to a disease that they could otherwise prevent. And if everyone did it, it could have devastating effects for broader public health. So The key is we are all making choices, either to try to make contact or not to make contact. And we have no basis for saying that making the initiative, making contact is riskier than receiving a message, because we could well have offsetting benefits that we would otherwise forego. Mm-hmm. So by making contact, we may learn what it is that other civilizations did to make it through their technological adolescence.
It does ultimately get down to this question, which is not just METI. I mean, it's a whole host of other questions that we're wrestling with now with our amazing technological progress that we've made, of whether it's things like building super intelligent computers or trying to cure death or all these other, you know, ambitious goals that you sometimes hear from, particularly from Silicon Valley. These are decisions that, you know, affect us all, affect the whole planet. The problem is, if you don't build those systems, if you don't build decisions that can wrestle with these kinds of issues, then it just means that the gamblers end up always making the choice for us. The people who are willing to take the risk will then take the risk, and we'll all be kind of stuck in the consequences of their actions.
And finally, Doug, let's say that you're wrong and that it doesn't work and the message is sent, but it kind of just ends up in the ether. What then?
If we are listening hundreds or thousands of years from now for a reply to our messages, and year after year after year, all we hear is this deafening silence. Mm-hmm. I think it will tell us that humanity is incredibly rare, at least insofar as a civilization who is willing to try to make contact with other intelligence in the universe. And that in itself is inherently valuable.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, Doug. Good luck, I mean it, on behalf of all of us.
Thanks very much.
Here's what else you need to know today. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell unveiled a new version of the Republican health care plan on Thursday, the latest attempt to win over enough senators to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Unlike the previous bill, the new proposal is designed to appeal to moderate Republican senators by leaving in place the Affordable Care Act's taxes on the wealthy, and to conservative senators by allowing insurers to offer health plans that do not comply with ACA standards. But two key senators immediately said they would not even support bringing the bill to a vote: Susan Collins of Maine and Rand Paul of Kentucky. If a single additional Republican senator joins them in opposing the bill, the latest version of the legislation will die. The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Lindsay Garrison, Rachel Quester, and Andy Mills. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Special thanks to Martha Daniel, Michaela Bouchard, Peter Sale, Pedro Rosado, Michael Simon Johnson, Matt Apuzzo, and Matt's wife, Becky. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you Monday.